Europe has once again become the epicenter of the COVID pandemic. The WHO is warning of 500,000 more deaths by February. But vaccines are readily available. So what's gone wrong? And will Europeans have to spend another winter in lockdown? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Rob Matheson. Now, in the warm months of July and August, much of Europe gave the impression the worst of the pandemic was over. Countries lifted their COVID-19 restrictions. People travelled for holidays again, gathered in large numbers, and you didn't need to wear masks in many places. But infections are now rising to record levels. The World Health Organization says the region is once again the centre of the pandemic. It's urging governments to reimpose restrictions and step up vaccination campaigns. Now, vaccines are readily available, but many people still refuse to take them. We're going to bring in our guests in a moment, but first, this report by Jonah Hull.
While many people are out and about as if the COVID-19 threat has passed, the World Health Organization says the wider European region is once more at the pandemic's epicenter. Across 53 countries, including parts of Central Asia, there are 78 million current infections. That's more than the cumulative total of Southeast Asia, the Eastern Mediterranean, and all of Africa. And it's a figure rising by a quarter of a million new infections daily, with 3,600 deaths every day.
According to one reliable projection, if we stay on this trajectory, we could see another 500,000 COVID-19 deaths in Europe and Central Asia by the 1st of February next year.
Why is it happening in a region with generally good access to vaccines? The WHO points to waning immunity among those vaccinated 6 months or more ago and vaccine hesitancy in countries like Russia, where misinformation on social media has contributed to more than 1,000 virus deaths a day. There's also the relaxation of public health measures. England, for example, where mandatory restrictions were lifted in July, is now responsible for around 1 in 10 of all new infections worldwide. Efforts to distribute booster jabs are being hampered by public apathy. Yet the government is resisting calls from scientists to reintroduce precautions or risk an even more deadly winter. There is a glimmer of good news. The UK has become the first country in the world to license a new treatment for COVID-19. Described as potentially game-changing, the antiviral pill made by US pharmaceutical company Merck has been shown to halve the chances of dying or being hospitalised for those most at risk of severe symptoms of the disease.
This pill interferes with the virus's replication mechanisms, and by interfering with how it reproduces, it makes it make many mistakes, and by making many mistakes, it stops it from being able to reproduce properly, and that's how it works.
But new treatments alone won't be enough to slow the renewed spread of the virus across Europe, among countries some of whom believed until recently that it was all over. Jonah Hull, Al Jazeera.
Well, the European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control says nearly 76% of people above the age of 18 are fully vaccinated. But this map shows huge differences between Western and Eastern Europe. Iceland, Ireland and Portugal, in the dark green, have immunised more than 90% of adults. That figure is just 39% in Romania and 26% in Bulgaria. Some countries have announced new measures. Latvia was the first EU nation to reimpose a lockdown last month. All public and most private gatherings have been banned, and people can only shop for essential goods. Estonia has cancelled all public events and stopped gatherings for non-vaccinated people. Those who have been fully vaccinated must wear masks indoors. And from Saturday, people in the Netherlands have been to wear masks in public areas and show vaccination passes to enter museums and gyms. Belgium has also reimposed mask wearing and encouraged people to work remotely after infections there hit their highest level in a year. OK, let's bring in our guests in Lucerne in Switzerland. We have Annelies Wilders-Smith. She's Professor of Emerging Infectious Diseases at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. In Birmingham in the UK, Lawrence Young, he's an infectious diseases specialist at Warwick University. And for Zielona Góra in Poland, Maria Gonciuk, she's head of the Department of Infectious Diseases at the University of Zielona Góra. A warm welcome to each of you. Annelies, I'm going to start with you. How different, if at all, is this scenario that we're seeing in Europe compared to the scenarios we saw in the early days of the pandemic?
The situation is similar, but also quite different. Last year, there was a rapid upsurge already starting in October, at a time when nobody was vaccinated. This time round, many have been vaccinated, not enough. But what we now see is, although we have a high number of infections, the number of deaths are lower than last year with the same number of infections. So the good news is, we have vaccines, and these vaccines do prevent deaths and severe disease. These vaccines do not prevent as successfully, though, mild infection. So you may still get mild infection, but the message is you are protected against severe disease and deaths.
Lawrence, is this just about low vaccination rates linked to higher levels of infection, or is there a wider question to this?
Yeah, I think it's a perfect storm, really. It's a combination of insufficient vaccine uptake and the easing of restrictions. And I think less mask wearing, more mixing indoors as the weather declines and gets colder, and waning immunity, actually, to vaccinations, particularly those that were vaccinated, you know, more than 6 months ago. So I think these are important factors. But I think it's the mix and the easing of restriction measures that are really contributing alongside low levels of vaccination in certain countries.
Maria, Germany's got a high rate of vaccinations. There was nearly about 80%, and yet its health minister is saying it's entering a fourth wave. Now, I know that Poland has a fairly high vaccination rate, and yet figures are rising there. What do you think is contributing to that?
Well, I don't think that the vaccination rate in Poland is high. It's about 53%. So we can do much better. But still, there are many hesitant individuals in the population. And I think this is one of the main drivers of this upsurge of cases in Poland at the moment. But also school opening, children are back in schools and students are back at the universities. These places are not having much regarding or doing much regarding implementing infection control measures. So people are very close to each other. And this is another factor which drives this surge in cases. Mm.
Maria, if the situation continues and the figures continue as we're seeing at the moment, what do you think is going to be the impact longer term in Poland?
Well, it depends. We have already developed some scenarios. But of course, everything depends on which assumptions you make in the beginning. So in this worst case scenario, when the government is practically doing nothing to stop new cases, so we will maybe end up with 35,000 cases reported every day. And according to these prognoses, we will face around 40,000 deaths in the end of this fourth wave.
Lawrence, let me ask you something about that Annelies mentioned earlier on. She's referred to the fact that the vaccines do seem to be having an impact because overall the number of hospitalizations and subsequent deaths seems to be falling. Is that something that is going to persuade people who are unwilling to up to this point about having the vaccine? Do you think that kind of impact that we're seeing, that the vaccines are actually reducing the number of deaths, could persuade people who have up until this point been reticent about it to actually go and take the vaccine?
I think it's a really important message, and perhaps we're not messaging this well enough across Europe. The vaccines are amazingly effective, more effective than we could have hoped for, actually, not only in preventing deaths, but also preventing hospitalizations. And I think it's partly not only thinking about yourself and your family, but also taking, if you like, the social responsibility that comes with vaccination. I think some of these messages have not been clear enough, but now we have so much real world evidence about the benefits of vaccination and the fact that there are very few associated side effects, that we need to be getting that story out to as many people as possible. And for people to realise that we're currently in a very, very precarious situation, that we can sort with vaccination. If we didn't have vaccination, goodness knows where we'd be. But these are very effective vaccines that we have available, and people should just go and get jabbed. Mm.
Annelise, one of the fundamental problems in this seems to be a lack of trust amongst a lot of people in terms of the government, in terms of the pharmaceutical companies, even, strangely enough, in terms of the WHO. People don't believe that some of the messaging that the WHO can be putting out at times. Why do you think that lack of trust has come in, and how is it that you get over that?
Social media is really our biggest enemy in this pandemic. You know, words matter and words can kill. And misinformation and intentional disinformation, conspiracy theories, are harmful. They kill. We need to become better communicators in the benefit of a vaccine, but also communicating this pandemic. It's, you know, it's an invisible virus, and young people think they are invincible. And this is now about a collective societal response to a very tragic pandemic. And we haven't had such a pandemic for decades. You know, our society is not trained. We are emotionally not ready for such a tragedy right now. Our daily lives are so disrupted. So indeed, it's a major challenge, and we need to get better in the media, in politics, in UN organizations and agencies, that we have an empathetic message that comes across all age groups and also all educational backgrounds.
Maria, is this the situation in Poland? Is social media and apparent misinformation playing a big role in the way that COVID is being dealt with there?
Well, I'm sure that there's one factor, but I would say that it's the litany of drivers of this hesitancy, in especially in post-communist countries. We don't have this long-lasting tradition of adult vaccination. What we do have is the mandatory vaccination regarding children, and we're really doing well just with the vaccination coverage of 90% to 90 even 80% among children. However, when you just think about flu vaccine, we are in Poland, we are in the bottom of the list of the countries, the EU countries, with vaccination coverage about 20%. It depends on the population group. But just to make the long story short, so there is no tradition of vaccination among adult population. But it's also the lack of trust in government and the lack of trust in experts. According to the latest research polls, they too trust more their relatives and friends than experts. So it's quite a challenge here to really give information which will be heard.
Why is it that the government seems able to introduce a mandatory vaccination program for children, and yet it seems unwilling to do that for adults?
Well, again, the problem is very complex. There is no tradition of vaccination among adults. So there are many anti-vaxxers, and according to the polls, These anti-vaxxers are supporters of the ruling party. So there are some conflicts, or I would say conflict of interests. Maybe the government just worries that some hard policies or mandatory policies regarding COVID vaccination will be badly received. Mm. And it will influence the polls.
Lawrence, this is clearly not. Sorry to interrupt, Lawrence. This is clearly not just a situation that exists in Poland. It exists in other countries as well. Interestingly, Russia is one of them. Now, one would have thought that, given the political circumstances in Russia, that introducing a vaccination across the country would be relatively easy. But I understand its vaccination rates are low, and of course, it produces its own vaccine. Why do you think that's happening there?
Well, I think a lot of this does come down across the whole of these different countries to trusting in the government. And I think there is an issue about trust. We're experiencing that in the UK, really, and to some extent, where there is so much complacency now, actually. And that complacency spread through society in a sense that actually this pandemic is somebody else's problem. We don't trust the government anymore. We don't believe in the information they're putting out. And I think that's one of the big issues in Russia, as well as in other countries. It's trusting the government and trusting, indeed, the vaccination process itself. I think there is a lot of concern, misunderstanding, misinformation and mistrust in Russia.
Anna Legis, we heard in Jonah's report just a moment ago that Merck has introduced a pill now for gives a vaccine, some form of vaccine. I understand that Pfizer is introducing another one as well. I think that might be correct. Do you think that that is going to make a difference in terms of persuading people that a vaccine is able to be taken? Is a pill easier to understand, if you like, than an injection? Is it less frightening? Will it actually make a difference?
So these antivirals, or these pills, they are indeed important additional tools. They cannot replace the vaccines. Remember, vaccines are meant to prevent cases, so you want to bring down the cases. If you don't prevent, you will just have, an explosive growth again of cases. And even if you now can treat some of them with a success rate of only about 50%, you will still overwhelm hospitals. So yes, we embrace every drug treatment. We need to manage these severely ill patients, but really to help us get out of this tragic pandemic, the strongest tool that we have at hand is a high vaccine coverage rate in all populations, but particularly amongst the older persons.
How easy is it going to be to persuade governments of countries that have a low vaccine rate to step up their efforts if they've not been able to achieve that in 2 years and yet the vaccines are available if they're willing to spend the money? Lawrence, let me ask you that first.
Well, I think they've just got to look at what's going on in their own countries and pay some attention to the horrific consequences of not giving a vaccine. If you have something that can prevent your population from getting sick and from being hospitalized and dying, then surely that's something that needs to be messaged very, very well. The other problem we have, of course, that we do need to stress is that as long as the virus continues to circulate in an unchecked way, it will change, and the virus could mutate again. And this would cause untold problems, as we are experiencing with the more transmissible Delta variant. So I think it comes back to the discussion we've just been having about governments taking the responsibility they have to protect their population. And in this instance, they've got something that really does do the heavy lifting, that really can protect. And if you have a preventative measure like this, why would you not want to make sure that your population is protected and indeed your own hospitals and health infrastructures protected?
Mm. Annalise, you said right at the start of this discussion that this wasn't just about the vaccinations. It was about the way that our society is responding to it in terms of mask wearing, in terms of social distancing. But of course, as we were saying, many people in Europe are now used to having a degree of freedom. It's going to be very difficult, isn't it, in order to be able to pull people back and say, actually, in order to fix this, we're going to take away those freedoms that you've just had and we're going to reimpose lockdowns, we're going to reimpose mask wearing. That's a big hurdle, isn't it?
Oh, indeed, a big hurdle, big challenge. People are fatigued. We all want to be out of this. And so we need to be creative, how to reach people who are otherwise difficult to reach, you know, offer vaccines at concerts, at football games, use every possible idea to increase vaccine uptake. And indeed, we need to learn how to better message the importance of vaccines.
Maria, it seems as though from past discussions that we've had that one of the most common solutions to this would be to effectively produce a society which is haves and have-nots. If you have the vaccine, then you can go out and lead a normal life. If you do not have the vaccine, then you cannot do X, Y, and Z. You cannot have a normal life. Is that something that is practical, do you think? Do you think at the end of the day, governments have to, as Lawrence was saying, step up and say, right, you get your freedoms if you have the vaccine, you have fewer freedoms if you don't?
Yes, I do support this idea, and it really works when we look at, for example, France or Italy. At the certain moment, their vaccinations or their vaccination campaigns seem to be not successful anymore, so they introduced COVID passports. And immediately there was a rise in the uptake. I think that it depends, of course, on the country. It depends on the society. It depends on the population group to which you address your campaigns, because you've got to speak different language to different groups. We have experienced that in Poland so far, that such messages should be oriented to young people in a different way than to the elderly, for example. So yes, we are now at a sort of plateau. There is no progress in vaccination at all in Poland. So people are still hesitant, about half of the population. So we've got to use any other tool which is supposed to work to increase the vaccination coverage.
Annelise, one would think, though, that we've got to a point after this length of time where people who refuse to take the vaccine, for whatever reason, whether it's a distrust of the government, distrust of the vaccine companies, or any other reasons, are really not going to shift their view unless they get very tangible evidence, and it's kind of overwhelming, and we're not really at that stage. Do you think that the situation that we've been discovering, this plateau that Maria was talking about, is going to continue actually for some time before we reach a point where something is going to shift?
I'm afraid that you're right. We have plateaued. Maybe we're successful in bringing that by another 5%, hopefully even 10%. But there will always be anti-vaxxers, and the ideology and the whole conspiracy around it is now so strong. It's now such a solid ideology. It will be hard to break through. So indeed, you know, measures like the US, but France, as we said, Italy have taken, where you have to have vaccine passports for certain professions and or to get into museums, etc., is the way to go. But there's also a danger in this. We are already a divided society. It will even divide it further. You get more anger, more hatred, more polarization. So it's all very, very tricky, the society that we are living in the moment.
Lawrence, just very quickly, just in a couple of sentences, how do you think this current situation is going to develop over, say, the next 6 months to a year?
I think it's really difficult to predict, because we know that unless we do get vaccination rolled out across a larger proportion of the population, the virus will continue to spread and continue to change and continue to cause sickness. And I think the problem we're all facing now is not only COVID, but the other respiratory virus infections like flu that we see over the winter months, and the enormous pressure that's going to put onto the health systems across Europe. So I think the winter is going to be very challenging. My view is, if we can make it to spring next year, we'll be in a much stronger position. But what toll is that going to take in the meantime?
Lawrence, thank you very much indeed. Now, thanks to all our guests, Annelise Willard-Smith, Lawrence Young and Maria Gunshuk. And thank you to you too for watching. You can see the programme again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Rob Matheson, and the entire team here, goodbye for now.